Before we get started, I'm going to give a brief description of what was happening and what caused the arrival. I got to spit this out, otherwise we're going to have problems. What caused the arrival or the arising of the historical Jesus pursuit, the quest of the historical Jesus? Please use the proper nomenclature. It is quest of the historical Jesus, not for. Even though it's just a preposition, it makes a major difference. The quest of the historical Jesus. What's happening, though, is this is coming out of the development of modernity. Let me just give you a brief overview of what happened in modernity, and then we'll dive into the quest. Modernity does not come out of societal rest. A lot of times people believe that everything was so tranquil and nice that they were able to think freely. And as a result, they came up with these amazing developments inside of reason and science and things of that nature. And that's just not true. As a matter of fact, Stephen Toulmin, in his book Cosmopolis, points out very clearly that what was happening during the time period that led to the Enlightenment was absolute chaos. And I'll read you his quote really quick. He says, "By 1600, the political dominance of Spain was ending. France was divided along religious lines. England was drifting into civil war. In Central Europe, the fragmented states of Germany were tearing one another apart. The Catholic princes being kept in line by Austria, and the Protestants, reinforced by Sweden. Economic expansion was replaced by depression. There was a grave slump from 1619 to 22. International trade fell away and unemployment was general, so creating a pool of mercenaries available for hire in the 30 Years' War. And all these misfortunes were aggravated by a worldwide worsening of the climate with unusually high levels of carbon in the atmosphere. This was the time of the Little Ice Age when the River Thames froze over at London and the whole oxen were roasted on the ice." So what is the time period from which the modernity arose? It was a time period of what?
Chaos.
And what ultimately the thinkers like John Locke and even and Descartes were trying to do was to find some stability, to find some certainty to counteract all the chaos. And what was developed is known as the Cartesian anxiety, which drives all of modernity. Cartesian anxiety is the spectrum where modernity basically believes that you are either in one of two categories, absolute chaos or absolute certainty. And so what Descartes and what Locke, from two different perspectives, Locke from empiricism, Descartes from reason, try to do is try to obtain absolute certainty to save them from the absolute chaos that was surrounding them. This is what modernity is developing out of. Modernity is really a survival tactic. The worship of reason and things of that nature come out of a period of chaos to ultimately lead them to what their goal is, and that's absolute certainty. Because if they have absolute certainty and they can find it in themselves, then no one can oppress them and no one can control them and no one can lead them into more chaos. So, several different things develop out of modernity, and I'm going to go over them briefly. The exaltation of reason develops out of this, because like I said, if you find objective truth, then you're able to, in a sense, control your own destiny. However, this exaltation of reason is also fueled by a hyper-skepticism, a distrust. You can't trust anyone or anything. The documents are suspect. The people talking to you about the documents are suspect. Even yourself, your senses cannot be trusted. The only thing that can be trusted is reason. I think, therefore I am. And the reason why this is happening is because they're trying to secure themselves from chaos. Another thing that happens during this time is hyper-categorization, compartmentalization, where one of the ways in which you can control things is if you put it in a category. This is the impetus of stereotypes. One of the ways in which we get around having to deal with the intricacies or the complexities of other people that we don't like or don't know is just by throwing them into a category, and then we don't really have to deal with them. Because in a sense, we control them by putting them in a category of maybe evil or not us. And if they're in that category, they're in some sense at a safe distance that would prevent us from falling into chaos. That develops out of modernity. And also what develops is a shift to human-centeredness. Naturalism really comes out of this. Deism really comes out of this. Things of that nature. All of this, though, is driven by the Cartesian anxiety, okay? That's all you really need to know. Does that make sense? During this atmosphere, this environment, develops the pursuit of the historical Jesus. which was quite odd any time before the time of the Enlightenment. Before the time of the Enlightenment, they would say, well, the Jesus of faith and the Jesus of history, there's no difference. And both of them you can find in the Gospels. Just go read it. Why do we need a quest of any of this if it's right there? All you have to do is read it. They would not see a distinction at all. But whenever you have the Enlightenment, what the Enlightenment does is it starts to say, no, there's a difference between history and faith. As a matter of fact, they are completely separate, and we'll get to how that has ramifications here in a bit. The Enlightenment, though, pushes biblical studies in a new direction of compartmentalization, hyper-skepticism, and the eradication of mystery. That is very important. Do you hear that? Eradication of mystery is the goal of Enlightenment. Why? Because mystery could lead us to chaos. You have to have an answer for everything. And if you don't, it is a threat to your very existence. Therefore, absolute certainty is what our goal needs to be in the Enlightenment. And if you can eradicate mystery, then you've achieved this goal, and no one can oppress you, and chaos can be avoided. Problem is, one of the prerequisites of faith is mystery. Whoops. I'm glad we're post-modernity now. kind of. In this environment, we then develops the old quest, or the first quest. It initially is called the old quest once the new quest starts, and it eventually becomes the first quest once the third quest begins. Does that make sense? The old quest is also the first quest, but it doesn't develop either of those names until later quests develop. Why? Because it wasn't old when it first started, it just was the quest. But when a new quest starts, then are you following me? So if I refer to the first quest or the old quest, I'm referring to this one. In particular, this quest develops from Ramirez to Schweitzer. And we'll talk about who those people are in just a moment. We need a little bit of background before we can even get to Ramirez, though. Ramirez, they're German. This is really primarily deriving out of the German school of thinking. But the Germans weren't developing this out of nothing. They were being influenced by the British and the French deists. Deists, everybody know what a deist is? Where you believe that there is a God, but he does not interact with the world at all. Naturalism develops out of this, things of that nature. The deists, that's why, you know, Thomas Jefferson has a Bible. He was a deist, and his Bible ends at the crucifixion because no miracles were allowed. Because God doesn't interact with the world like that. The British and the French deists begin to develop and lay a foundation that the first quest will launch from. You have different people like, you don't need to know these names, but if you notice these names, then you'll know where they come from. Benedict Spinoza, Richard Simon, Thomas Morgan, these are some of the French and British deists that lay the groundwork for the historical Jesus movement. In 1738, a deist by the name of Thomas Chubb published a book called The True Gospel of Jesus Christ Asserted. That's the name of it. The True Gospel of Jesus Christ Asserted. And he argues, remember, this is 1738, before Ramirez. He argues that the Jesus of history, the real Jesus, was deist-like. In the sense that he wasn't a miracle worker or anything like that. He was more of a person that kind of believed in a God but didn't really have God's power. But he said that later Christians, particularly the Apostle Paul, imposed the grandiose view of Jesus upon him. But that's never who he meant to be. And that happens a little bit before. But the real movement is picked up and really begun, according to Albert Schweitzer, by a guy by the name of Hermann Ramirez, who was alive from 1694 to 1768. And he is known as the father of the quest. What he adds to the equation that the deists were missing was a Jewish element. His goal was not to well, that's not exactly true. The tendencies of the deist, though, was to destroy the narrative. But he was trying to construct something that ultimately, though, would be leading to the destruction of other things. He offers the element of Jewish apocalyptic prophets. He comes along and basically, he has five teachings that are important. Let's just go through those. Number one, Ramirez taught that he believes that there is a separation between the Jesus of history and the Jesus of faith. You need to separate them. He agreed with Chubb on that point, that you need to separate them. And the Gospels present the Jesus of faith, and you need to separate that from the Jesus of history. Number two, he believed that the Jesus was a Jewish Jesus. Ramirez asserted that the historical Jesus was, quote, born of a Jew and intended to remain one. That's a key Ramirez presupposition. He was born a Jew and he intended to remain one. Paul. But the Christians hijacked him and used him for their own theology. Ramirez number 3 taught that Jesus came to establish a kingdom, but he came to establish a Jewish kingdom. Therefore, Ramirez argued that what Jesus proclaimed as the kingdom of God, he was anticipating what all the other Jews anticipated. And that was a political kingdom on earth with a base of power in Jerusalem that would ultimately be established through violent military force. Ramirez said he was a Jew through and through. When he said, I'm going to establish a kingdom, he meant it was going to be established through violence, through force, and rule from Jerusalem. Number 4, Ramirez concludes this about the Jesus of history. Ramirez says that Jesus, the real Jesus of history, was a wannabe Messiah who attempted to establish a political kingdom, but his plans were destroyed when he was arrested and crucified. Number 5, Ramirez then says that this is the development of Jesus, the Jesus of faith. That the disciples of Jesus, however, were not willing to let go the power that was promised them once he established his kingdom. Therefore, they fabricated the resurrection by stealing his body. Ramirez also believed that they then took and developed the Jesus of faith that put them in positions of power and dignity and honor. But ultimately, the Jesus of history was simply a wannabe Messiah that failed. Now, this document was actually never published in the lifetime of Ramirez. Ramirez was so afraid of what he had developed that he put it inside of a desk drawer, and his daughter found it when he died. And his daughter took it to a guy by the name of Gotthold Lessing, who published it anonymously over a period of 5 years, 1774 to 1778, and just little chunks at a time. Anonymously. And it was years later until it was finally found out that it was Ramirez was the one that wrote this. Now here is Ramirez's lasting impact. This is what is so significant that Ramirez develops that you will see going out through the rest of the quests. Number 1, the distinction between the Jesus of faith and history. He picks up what Chubb and the deists had brought about and he says, this is the right path. And this has actually become to be developed as an unquestioned presupposition of all the other questers that followed. There is a difference between the Jesus of faith and the Jesus of history. Number 2, Ramirez's also lasting impact is seen in his emphasis on Jewish eschatology. The debate even rages today in the third quest of how much did Jesus embrace the first century Jewish apocalyptic eschatology. How much did he agree with what the kingdom was going to be established and how is it going to be established that the Jews suggested? Those two impacts you'll see resonating throughout the rest of the quests. Part of the first quest as well is a significant figure that comes at it from a different perspective is a man by the name of David F. Strauss, 1808 to 1874. And notice the subtitle I gave this is From Deism to Legend Myth. In 1835, Strauss published a very controversial book known as The Life of Jesus Critically Examined. And basically he argues 4 things. Number 1. He emphasizes the emergence of myth. He's bringing this concept of myth to the table. Strauss believed that one of the key things that the naturalist, he was a naturalist, but he said one of the key things the naturalists are overlooking, what the naturalists are constantly trying to do is they're looking at the Gospels and saying, this is just a misunderstanding, a web of misunderstanding of things that are happening that the disciples are recording. It's just a web of misunderstandings. They thought he healed the person, but there's actually a natural explanation. And Strauss comes along, he says, I don't totally disagree with that. He said, but what you're missing is the concept of myth. That myth has a power amongst a society that you can't overlook. Therefore, even if you have a natural explanation to it, it doesn't matter. You need to keep in perspective the concept of myth. The importance of myth is the second thing that he emphasized. Not just that the myth is there, but he says, this is the importance of the myth. And I'll quote Strauss here. He says, the major advantage of this approach is, quote, it leaves the substance of the narrative unassailed. And instead of venturing to explain the details, it accepts the whole, not indeed as true history, but as sacred legend. He says, that's what I'm bringing to the table. That's the importance of what I'm doing. The third thing he points out in his book is the source of the myth. Strauss suggests that the early Christians utilized the Old Testament stories and the concepts in order to develop the Jesus of faith. Therefore, if you can see where these are overlapping, you then can try to pull away the myth they've developed to see what's left behind their history of the historical Jesus. And that's fourth. The conclusion was that through this practice, through this methodology, you can find some bare facts about the historical Jesus that can be safely attributed to him and be separated from the mythical Jesus that the church had developed. So you see what he brings to the table? The concept of myth, he says, if we just figure out where the source of the myth is, pull that away, then we can actually find the historical Jesus. Now, Strauss has a lasting impact as well, and there's two of these. Number one, this is the beginnings. Yes?
What was the fourth thing there?
Fourth thing was his conclusion that the bare facts of what is left over after you pull away the myth, the bare facts is what we can ultimately, where we can ultimately find the historical Jesus. His lasting impact is twofold. Number one, this is the beginnings of form criticism. This is the beginnings. Real important development. This will actually be something that's very important at the in the No Quest period, as well as in the Second Quest with Rudolf Bultmann at the helm. Form criticism is huge to Bultmann. We'll see that here in just a bit. But number two, the lasting impact was there's the reactions to Strauss. There's two different reactions to Strauss that really have an impact on the development of the quest. Number one, some people began to overemphasize the myth concept. And they basically, matter of fact, a guy by the name of Bruno Bauer suggests that all of the gospel was a myth, and therefore nothing was history. Therefore, Jesus never really lived, but he was completely fabricated. Completely. And there are some people that still believe that today, by the way. Not very many. They're very few and far between. As a matter of fact, most scholars laugh at them. Jimmy Dunn really does laugh at one of the guys he's responding to in the book, The Five Views of the Historical Jesus. He laughs at the guy that argues that Jesus never really lived. Anyway, read it. It's funny. The second reaction, though, to Strauss was the emergence of the two-source theory. Oh, ding, ding, ding. What we talked about last time. Two classes ago. The two-source theory actually develops, initially, as a way to explain the synoptic problem, but also as a way of proving the historicity of the Gospels, as opposed to just letting it go into the oblivion of myth. It actually was an apologetic method that was initially used. And the concept behind it was, if we latch onto Mark as a Gospel that is strictly trying to give us the history, and that was one of the key sources of the Gospels. And then Q, which is something that is only the sayings at this time, although in the Second Quest it becomes a full-blown Gospel. But the Q, if it's just the sayings, then we don't have to deal with all the miracle stuff that's within the narratives. From these two sources, we then can develop the historical Jesus, not a Jesus that's just mythical. So the reactions to Strauss are very, very important. Hopefully you can see that. Okay, some of the conclusions, though, of this this first quest, before we get to the death of it, is that with the emergence of the two-source theory, a lot of confidence was rested in the fact that we can find the historical Jesus. In particular, what was said to be a major accomplishment was that they found that the historical Jesus was a good moral reformer who taught a reasonable, love-based religion. And that you can see this once you pull away all of his miracles and all the claims to divinity. That's who the real historical Jesus was. And the rest of it's just been added in. And they saw this as a major success, primarily driven by the two-source theory, a major success of what we've accomplished. We have gotten to the historical Jesus. And then comes this stinking little guy by the name of William Red. This guy delivers a death blow to the historical Jesus whenever he publishes an essay on the Messianic secret. The Messianic secret in Mark. Specifically, what he says is, number one, you can trace that there is a Messianic secret. And he says that the Messianic secret is a literary development that was put onto the gospel account by post-Easter redactors or post-Easter reflectors. The people that wrote it were reflecting upon Jesus and their theology, and the Messianic secret develops as a literary tool within that. Now, why is that a major problem for the first questers? What?
It was supposed to be just a historical.
Because the Gospel of Mark was supposed to be clear of any theological reflection and just a historical account of what actually happened. But whenever he shows that there is a clear a literary element that's driving throughout the whole book, all of a sudden their key source begins to crumble. Instead, what he shows is that, largely the Gospel of Mark is like the other Gospels. Chronology was not his primary purpose, but a theological portrayal of Jesus is what his goal was. As a result, disenchantment began to seep into the quest of the historical Jesus. The next person that kind of is accredited with the conclusion or the end of the first quest is a guy by the name of Albert Schweitzer. Albert Schweitzer in 1906 published a book, The Quest of the Historical Jesus, where we get all the nomenclature with which we dialogue about this. The Quest of the Historical Jesus in 1906, which ultimately ends the quest, even though I don't think that was his intention. I don't think Schweitzer meant to end the quest at all, but ultimately he does, and we'll talk about why that is. But first of all, let's talk about the impact of the book. Schweitzer, hold on, wait a minute. Oh, suggests that what we had hoped for, that we could accomplish, this absolutely objective and free from subjectivity Jesus, the historical Jesus, he said ultimately has proven to be futile. Because, he insinuates in his last chapter, that what we usually see is, when we look at the interpretations of the people that are interpreting, you usually see the interpreter himself inside the interpretation. And he says that's a problem, because not only are we fighting the agendas then of the gospel writers, we're fighting our own agendas as well. This lays a big layer, a big problem that would separate us from ultimately achieving the historical Jesus free from theological reflection. Yes?
Can you say that again?
Not only are they fighting the agenda of the writers of the historical Jesus, the theological reflections of the Christians on the gospel, the documents themselves, we're fighting our own presuppositions as agendas as well, because every time we're interacting with these, our interpretation of Jesus, Schweitzer says, looks an awful lot like us. So our presuppositions is another layer that the Enlightenment tends to overlook. We tend to overcredit what we can do as far as separating ourselves from the documents that we're looking at and achieving this level of objectivity. The second thing he showed that he does, though, even though in light of that, Schweitzer still makes a conclusion. And Schweitzer says this. He says, if you put together all the pictures that was left over from all the details that were not completely irrecoverable of the historical Jesus, you do get an answer. And specifically, Schweitzer says that Jesus was a lot like Ramirez. He was a failed apocalyptic prophet that predicted the end of the world that never really came. As a matter of fact, let me read to you the quote of how Schweitzer pictures Jesus. He says, this comes from The Quest of the Historical Jesus. He says, there is silence all around. The Baptist appears and cries, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Soon after that comes Jesus, and in the knowledge that he is coming, the coming Son of Man, lays hold of the wheel of the world to set it moving on the last revolution, which is to bring all ordinary history to a close. You see how he's developing this? He says, there's silence all around. John the Baptist comes, says, the kingdom is coming. And Jesus emerges and he says, he sees the wheel of history moving and latches onto it to make its one final revolution that would ultimately bring ordinary history to a close. He goes on, he says, but it refuses to turn. And he throws himself upon it. Then it does turn and it crushes him. Instead of bringing in the eschatological conditions, he has destroyed them. The wheel rolls onward in the mangled body of the one immeasurably great man who is strong enough to think of himself as the spiritual ruler of mankind and to bend history to his purpose is hanging upon that wheel still. That is his victory and his reign. That's the historical Jesus for Schweitzer. Ultimately, what Schweitzer says is if we pull away all the outdated Jewish theology, we get rid of all of the different miracle things that keep us from understanding the real true historical Jesus, what we will find is a message of love that Jesus perpetuated that we can embrace. Make sense what he said? Not do you agree, but does it make sense what he said? Okay. And that, ultimately, most people, when they're looking and documenting this, they would say Schweitzer's book, The Quest of the Historical Jesus, documents not just the first quest, but also ends it. Because we then move into a period that's called the No Quest period. From Schweitzer to Kosseman, from 1906 to 1953, we primarily do not really see anyone pursuing the quest at all. It's been largely abandoned. And there's several reasons for this. Number one, the problem of subjectivity. What Schweitzer surfaced in his book, people really believed. They said, you're right. There is an irrecoverable problem with subjectivity that we can't get away from. As a matter of fact, George Tyrell stated it this way. He says, basically Schweitzer is true, that whenever the scholar gazes into the deep well of history in search of Jesus, there is always the real hazard of seeing merely one's own reflection gazing back and mistaking that for Jesus. You see what he said? We look into the deep well, and we're trying to find the historical Jesus. The danger is that we don't really accomplish Jesus. We just see our own reflection bouncing back. People will try to credit that to Schweitzer. It's Schweitzer's idea, but that's Tyrell's language. The problem of objectivity, the pervasive skepticism that was driving this goal of arriving at an objective picture. Basically, they would say, what we have proven through this quest so far is that it's not attainable. So largely in this 50-year period or so, people began to abandon it. Second reason is the lack of satisfaction with Schweitzer's Jesus. What the conclusion was of this historical Jesus pursuit, many of the Europeans were not willing to accept. They said, that is an unacceptable Jesus. If that's what he's reduced down to, the historical Jesus, we don't want anything a part of it. And really, Schweitzer prognosticated, he foresaw this. He says, in The Quest of the Historical Jesus, he says, the study of the life of Jesus has had a curious history. It set out in quest of the historical Jesus, believing that when it found him, it could bring him straight into our time as teacher and savior. It says, but he does not stay. He passes by our time and returns to his own. Number three, and that was unacceptable to the European scholars, so they largely abandoned this. Number three, the rise of form criticism begins to really take the show for the next 50 years and kind of put the historical Jesus to the side. With the likes of Rudolf Bultmann at the helm, the advancements of form criticism began to suggest that the entire notion of being able to recover the historical Jesus was just flat out impossible. Matter of fact, Rudolf Bultmann says this. He says, I do indeed think that we can know almost nothing concerning the life and personality of Jesus, since the early Christian sources show no interest in either the life or the personality, are moreover fragmentary and often legendary, and other sources simply do not exist. He says, in light of this issue, recovering the historical Jesus, even pursuit of that, is stupid, because we know that the myths that lay over it are pretty much all that's there. Number four, the relationship of faith and history. The rise of people during this time period like Karl Barth, Emil Brunner, Paul Tillich, and others began to basically say the pursuit of a historical Jesus separate from a Jesus of faith, by definition, is anti-gospel. It's not possible. And we shouldn't even be pursuing it anyway, because that's against the heartbeat of the gospel. To eradicate faith is to simply not even to have the lenses with which we can see any Jesus, according to a lot of these, the neo-Orthodox and people that developed. Martin Kaler says this, he actually writes this at the end of the 19th century, or end of the beginning of the 20th century. The end of the 19th century, that was accurate, yeah. He says, the historical Jesus of modern authors conceals from us the living Christ, because Christian faith and a history of Jesus repel each other like oil and water. Says the pursuit itself, the inquiry itself, is attacking the one thing that we have to have in our community, and that's faith. So this 50-year period goes on where largely we don't have, the quest goes into, it's out of vogue. Nevertheless, in 1953, a new quest begins. And there's really some ironic beginnings of this new quest, and that's what I have listed up here for you. The ironic beginnings, first of all, it begins with Ernst Kosseman. Ernst Kosseman is, let me just go in order. A critique of the first quest begins with the launch of the second quest. His lecture that he delivers on October 20th, 1953, called The Problem of the Historical Jesus, the intention of it was to critique the first quest, saying this is what went wrong. And he basically affirms the historical and theological difficulties and recounts them that led to their demise. Second thing that's somewhat ironic is in this critique, the person and the location of the launch of this new quest. Ernst Constantin was a student of Rudolf Bultmann. The guy that launches the second quest is a student of the guy that thought that the quest, that a quest at all was ludicrous. And he even launches the second quest. This lecture that he gives is in the presence of Rudolf Bultmann at the annual meeting of Bultmann and all the students. A third irony is the theological reason to start the new quest for a historical Jesus. Ernst Constantin says this: "We also cannot do away with the identity between the exalted and the earthly Lord without falling into docetism." We'll pull that out in a minute. "Conversely, neither our sources nor the insights we have gained from what has gone before permit us to substitute the historical Jesus for the exalted Lord. The clash for the, over the historical Jesus has as its object a genuine theological problem." He says this: "It is not okay. It is not okay for what the first quest did, to basically mitigate and destroy the Jesus of faith in favor of the Jesus of history." But he says to put down the pursuit of the historical Jesus is just as problematic, because docetism, a church heresy, is a belief that Jesus, it was a denial of Jesus' humanity and the exaltation of only his deity. And he says if we do not pursue the historical Jesus, then we are committing docetism. Therefore, he has a theological reason to develop, once again, a new quest. Is this making sense? He says the first quester's problem was is they were committing the theological fallacy, of setting aside the divinity of Jesus and only focusing on the human. He said, but we've committed an equally damaging problem, and that is setting aside the humanity of Jesus to only focus on the Jesus of faith. He says, theologically, we are bound, in order not to commit docetism again, to pursue the Jesus of history. This comes the fourth irony. The fourth irony is the purpose of the new quest. The first quest commenced when Ramirez attempted to separate the Jesus of history and the Jesus of faith as a means to show the futility of the Jesus of faith. His goal is to separate them to destroy one. But the second quest begins to try to show that there is continuity between the Jesus of faith and the Jesus of history. While the first one tries to separate Jesus, the second one tries to bring these two together. That's a bit ironic. Anybody following the irony there? Somewhat chuckling? Okay. The second quest, though, ironically, never really seems to have an ending. We don't really know when the ending is, hence 1970s-ish. It's somewhere around then. And when some people would even say, we don't even really know if the second quest has ever really stopped. And we'll talk about why that makes sense in a minute. But some of the key things that developed during this time period, some of the key people, let me give you some key people of the second quest. C.H. Dodd is some of the people that took upon this challenge by Constantin to do it. C.H. Dodd, Gunther Bornkim, Norman Perrin, Edward Schillebex, these type of people and others are ones that said, yes, we will embrace this. So when you see these different names, know that they're coming in the second quest. You can get a list of the names of me for later. One of the key things that develops out of the second quest is the methodology of the double dissimilarity. Double dissimilarity. Write that down. Double dissimilarity. Very important. And Norman Perrin defines double dissimilarity as follows. And then after I define it through his words, I'll define it in words that make sense. He says, "The earliest form of a saying we can reach may be regarded as authentic if it can be shown to be dissimilar to characteristic emphases both of ancient Judaism and of the early church." In other words, he's saying, the historical Jesus elements can be found. Whenever we find elements that do not agree, we can show no influence by Judaism in this element, and no influence of Christianity in this element. At that point, it is doubly dissimilar to both Judaism and Christianity, and therefore must be an element that goes back to the historical Jesus. You see the methodology? Double dissimilarity comes out of this. The end of the second quest, there's no universal agreement. We just kind of see something emerging in the 1970s to 80s. As a matter of fact, the term third quest is coined in an article by N.T. Wright in 1982. Yes, he's not just a Paul guy. N.T. Wright, in an article called "Towards a Third Quest, Jesus Then and Now," coins the term. But when he initially used the term, he was not trying to use the term in a chronological manner. He did not believe that the third quest, that using that term, was saying that the second quest was over. What he was arguing for was a new methodology. not a new chronology. Does that make sense? Third, not in the sense of comes after second, but third in the sense of alongside of the first and second, a methodology that we can add into this inquiry. Nevertheless, regardless of what N.T. Wright meant for the term to be used, it's now been hijacked, and primarily it's used to emphasize chronology. Specifically, people point to the date 1985 as the pivotal year. Whenever people begin to look around and realize that something different is happening inside of the study of the historical Jesus. 1985 was a pivotal year because it saw the production of E.P. Sanders' book, Jesus and Judaism, and it saw the launching of what was known as the Jesus Seminar. Same year. Something new is happening. Over the next 20 to 30 years, as these two quests maybe are going on simultaneously, or maybe a new quest altogether has emerged, over the next 20 to 30 years, some major people begin to develop as doing this new methodology of the historical Jesus. So some of those people are as follows. Ben Meyer, E.P. Sanders, Geza Vermes, Marcus Borg, John Dominic Crossan, Robert Funk, who's the founder of the Jesus Seminar, James Dunn, Richard Baucom, and others. These are some of the major players of the third quest, okay? Now we need to talk about what has emerged. We need to appreciate the advances of the third quest, because what has emerged is quite significant. Particularly, what the third quest is best known for is two things. Number one, methodologies. Methodologies. They are very clear on what methodologies they are using and why they are using them and why they are justified in using them. Number two, they are also very open about their presuppositions, something that the first and the second quest did not have. They come and they say, this is my presupposition. This is the lens with which I'm reading. I'm not going to apologize for it. I'm just going to tell you it. Some of these methodologies and tactics in the third quest that are debated upon how to do it, especially the first two. The first one is atomism versus holism. Atomism is basically the methodology of trying to find the little tidbits of information in the authentic historical Jesus. Through pulling away the myths, through other methodologies, you find the little tidbits, the little pieces. And then from the little pieces, you piece all together this picture of who the historical Jesus was. So they focus on this in order to get to this. That's what atomism does. Does that make sense? We've talked about atomistic exegesis at the very beginning of this class. Where if you just stay in atomistic exegesis, you never get the whole picture. But their way of getting to the whole picture is by looking at the little bits and then coming back. This is the Jesus Seminar. We're going to vote on every single little phrase of whether or not we think it was authentic or not. And at the end of it, we'll piece together everything that we've got was authentic, and that will be what Jesus is. But then you have holism. The other methodology that says, no, we're going to start with the big picture hypothesis. This is who we think Jesus is. And then they're going to go through to try to either falsify or validate their hypothesis, the big picture. So they start out here, and then they move in here to either validate or invalidate the big picture. And this is the perspective, this is the tactic of John Dominic Crossan. This is what N.T. Wright does, what James Dunn does, those types of people. So the two different types of methodology. Even within this, there's even arguments, though, even within the atomism and the holism. And that is, do we start with the deeds of Jesus? Do we just start with the sayings? Can we even trust the deeds? Do we need to get rid of them all completely? Can we only trust the sayings? Which sayings do you trust? There's a lot of debate over word or deed, word or deed. The double dissimilarity debate. Some people still, even coming out of the second quest, still latch on to double dissimilarity. And that, in particular, a good example of that, again, is the Jesus Seminar. Whenever I'm saying the Jesus Seminar, you guys all understand what I'm talking about? The group of scholars in 1985, all the way up, and they finished their inquiry about 10 years ago of what the real historical Jesus said. They all got together and they went line by line of all the Gospels, including the Gospel of Thomas. And they were asking the question, is this an authentic saying of Jesus? And they would vote on it with their little rocks, the colored rocks. That's what I'm talking about. They bought in hook, line, sinker to double dissimilarity. They said, absolutely, if there is Jewish influence, it can't be the historical Jesus. If it's Christian influence, it can't be the historical Jesus. But some people have come along, and there's two different objections to that particular type of thinking. Number one, some believe that double dissimilarity distances Jesus from Judaism. And that's a major problem for a lot of third questers. The Jewishness of Jesus is a key unanimous agreement amongst most third questers that he was Jewish. But if you have to pull away everything that is Jewish influenced on Jesus, then are you really getting the true historical Jesus, is some of them ask. And then they also say the exact opposite thing. If you take away everything that is Christian, the Christian community latched on to Jesus for some reason. It wasn't because he was totally dissimilar to them. It was because he shared some things from which they derived from him. Therefore, if you get rid of all Christian elements of Jesus, do you really have a true historical Jesus? Because where did the Christian community come up with it anyway? You see the problem with that? They're saying if we strip away Judaism and Christianity, are we really left with the historical Jesus? Or are we left with what's left over? We don't even know what's left over. Ultimately, though, if Jesus is not Jewish and he has no influence on Christianity, it may not really be the true Jesus we're looking for. So some people get rid of double dissimilarity along those lines and begin to use all the evidence that's available in order to come up with their picture. N.T. Wright's a major advocate against double dissimilarity. He's not a fan. Number three, this is a methodology that a lot of people begin to use, though. Multiple independent attestation. It's the methodology that says if it can be found in multiple unrelated sources, then more than likely it's something that goes back to the historical Jesus. Matter of fact, John Dominic Crossan, talking about the advantages as a major advocate of this particular methodology, says that the complete avoidance of any, that you should completely avoid any unit of the Jesus tradition found in only one single attestation, even if it's within the first stratum, even if it's within one of the earliest documents we have. If that is the only place it is found, you shouldn't even really mess with it. Because multiple independent attestation is the only way we can assure we're getting back to the historical Jesus. Number four, the embarrassment element. This is what it sounds like. Ultimately, they would say that Christians would not be fabricating things that would embarrass them or Jesus. Therefore, if we have elements of embarrassment, then ultimately that would probably point back to the historical Jesus. Otherwise, they would have gotten rid of them. Does that make sense? I don't need to go on further on that, right? One of the key developments of the third quest that's really been good, which hopefully you will recognize the importance of this since it's something we've been talking about a lot, is interdisciplinary studies. In order to develop the historical Jesus, everyone's getting involved. You have archaeologists weighing in. You have philosophers weighing in, sociologists, people from oral cultures or the studies of oral traditions, like we talked about with Richard Bailey. You have empire studies. All of these are people contributing to the third quest. And before, it wasn't. You didn't have all these interdisciplinary studies in the first and second quest. But the third quest, that's a key characteristic. And number six, the use of non-canonical sources is something that third questers, in some sense, bring over from Rudolf Bultmann. Bultmann believed that in using the non-canonical books, you are releasing... Let me rephrase that. Rudolf Bultmann talked about the myth that was that was laid over Jesus to where he was irretrievable. The historical Jesus you could not get back to. Nevertheless, what some of the third questers say is if we use the non-canonical sources, it can free us from the tyranny of the Gospels that keep the historical Jesus locked up. Therefore, Gospels like the Gospel of Thomas, the Q Gospel, the secret Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Peter, become significant sources for third questers that are trying to free the Jesus of history from the tyranny of the Gospels, synoptics. Now, I'm going to... we have 4 minutes. You kidding me? How you like that, huh? There are 10 things that the historical Jesus... And I don't have this on a slide because I just didn't. But these should be easy enough to where you can write them down. 10 things that there is general consensus from the third questers on 10 elements about the historical Jesus. 10 things that pretty much all of them say that definitely is a part of the historical Jesus picture. Okay? First one, Jesus was Jewish. Pretty much every third quester would say that is a non-negotiable. He is Jewish. And I have a quote here from John Meyer, who basically says, if nothing else is really developed from the third quest, if everything else fails, this advancement in the Jewishness of Jesus is a major accomplishment. Number two, most third questers believe that Jesus was considered by his contemporaries an exorcist and a miracle worker. Big development. Because the first quest was basically just trying to get rid of all those elements because they were embarrassing. And the third quest comes along and they says, no, there's too much extra biblical attestation of the miracle working of Jesus and the casting out of demons. We even see it in the way in which some of the Jewish documents refer to Jesus. His contemporaries thought he was a miracle worker. And that's something that the third questers all pretty much agree upon. Number three, all of them pretty much agree upon that Jesus was baptized by John. that Jesus was baptized by John? Number 4. Am I okay to move on? That Jesus taught and preached in Galilee. Pretty much all the third questers agree that he did teach and he did preach in Galilee. You might be thinking, man, these are insignificant. You got to remember what they're trying to do. Develop the historical Jesus. What did he really look like? Every element then, every piece of him then, is up for debate. But these are ones they've all kind of landed on saying, no, these are true of the historical Jesus. Number 5, Jesus drew followers to himself. That is something that they have said that was about the historical Jesus. You can affirm that people did follow him. Number 6, Jesus did make a final journey to Jerusalem for Passover. Pretty big deal. Jesus did make a final journey to Jerusalem for Passover. Number 7. Jesus had an incident in the temple in the final week of his life. Something did happen in the temple the final week of his life. Some sort of incident. That is something we can say about the historical Jesus according to the third quest. Number 8. Jesus was arrested. The historical Jesus was arrested. Number 9. Jesus was convicted by Pontius Pilate. You see that in a lot of different places outside of the Bible. And number 10, the 10th and final element that they all agree upon is that Jesus was crucified. Everybody agrees on those. Most. Everybody in the third quest agrees on those. As a result of these different elements and the different methodologies, some of the different pictures of Jesus that have emerged in the third quest are he was an eschatological prophet, which is in some sense hearkening back to Schweitzer. N.T. Wright would actually find himself in that camp somewhat. He actually is quite a big fan of Schweitzer on that angle. A Galilean holy man, Jesus was an occult magician. He was a Jewish sage, according to some of them, a political revolutionary. Thank you, Richard Horsley. Or I guess you could even say a community reformer of sense. A cynic philosopher and other stuff. Yeah, question, clarification.
Number 10, Jesus crucified, that all of them affirm he died being crucified?
He died being crucified, yes. And that really comes from the multiple independent attestation. We even have non-Christian documents that affirm that he was crucified. Now, here is some of the questions. I'm going to tell you what I've asked Helen Bond to talk about. Tomorrow, I've asked her to talk about 15 to 20 minutes of. Where is the third quest at now? And where does she see it moving? Does that make sense? I didn't ask her to recap on the first and second quest. You needed to know that to understand where the third quest came from and why it's there. But I've asked her to talk about where she sees the third quest at and where she sees it moving in the next 15 to 20 years. You can ask her any question, though. Any questions open? I'll give you an idea of some of the questions that I'm thinking of, so maybe it'll spawn some questions that you're thinking of. I want to know, what role, if any, do you see the Gospel of John playing in the quest of the historical Jesus in the coming future? Because I think there's a major movement starting to emerge that the Gospel of John will either come alongside the third quest or start a whole new one. And actually, I'm really interested in maybe playing a part in that someday. The next question you don't need to worry about. I'm just curious about what she thinks of Dale Allison's work. Francis Watson, Jimmy Dunn, and others suggest that really there is no possible way to separate the historical figure from the way in which he is preserved in the community that remembers him. How do you respond to them? Are they accurate from your perspective? Francis Watson says, we need to do what the first quest did, and that's abandon this quest at all costs. This is just ridiculous. Francis Watson came from Durham and gave a lecture at Edinburgh whenever I was there on that topic. And another question I'm thinking of is, how does memory play into the way in which we interact with the gospel narratives and the historical Jesus, building off of the work of Chris Keith, Richard Bailey, and Jimmy Dunn? So those are some of the things I'm thinking. So other things, the way they affect in your book, the way Empire Studies affects, etc. Make sense? Okay. Love you guys. See you tomorrow.